And over in the right, it's Mysterioso, and we're here with Joe Barotti just a minute. Dropkick me, Jesus.
Bring on the brothers who've gone on before.
Yeah.
And all the sisters who've knocked on your door.
We're just hanging out in the living room.
Get your hands up.
Stand where you are. Don't move.
Don't reach for them guns.
Take it easy, you galoots. Put away the hardware and relax.
It's Greg.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Yeah, we won't let that run anymore. That's just ridiculous. Hey, it's Radio Mysterioso here for the, what is today, the 14th, 15th? What the hell day is it? 12th? 11th? It's the 11th.
The 11th, 7-Eleven, yeah.
So that's right. Don't they have free Slurpees today at 7-Eleven?
You know, you might be right. What
do.
Are we doing here?
Well, we have till midnight, right? I think they had some other contest going for 7-Eleven, too. Anyway, my guest today, my first ever music guest, and we're going to leave that open because it's hot in here, yeah. Because everybody can hear us. And the thing is that part of this show is the fact that at least once during every show, a incredibly loud fire engine or police car comes through because
imagine.
It's a main thoroughfare. They always use Beverly for some reason. Vermont, there's never anybody going this way. They're always coming this way on Beverly. Right. I don't know why.
Well, that'll be exciting.
So I've never had a musical guest ever on my show ever in the entire history of my show.
That's
since.
That's amazing. It's like
since it was on KBLT in the late 90s.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's a long time. It's funny because you're such a music guy.
Yeah,
to me, I think.
I guess. Well, that's how I know you. My guest is Joe Barotti. He's a drummer and other instruments, too, that we'll discuss, but mainly known as a percussionist and incredibly talented one. And every time I see him, I'm just kind of amazed to watch that anybody could polyrhythm stuff out that like Joe does.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And the first time I saw you performing ever, it was at USC when the Fibonacci's opened for...
Yeah, Oingo Boingo.
Yeah.
You were there?
Yeah.
Really?
There was a guy in the second row, and people were booing. I clapped and cheered, and I think...
you were the one guy.
Yeah. And
that's amazing that you were there. I don't remember you mentioning that. You might have mentioned it because that's pretty memorable.
Yeah. well, it is for me.
It's good.
Yeah.
The gig was for us was very memorable.
why is that?
Well, we don't always get gym socks get pelted with gym socks from frat
Did that
boys.
Happen?
Yeah.
Wow.
They hated us. It was the story on that is that we. it's funny because I just saw this guy just this weekend. Rich Gibbs is a guy that I grew up with in Florida.
Yeah.
And we played music together. He was, when I moved out here a long time ago, he was my roommate. He had a house in Burbank that I, so I moved out here and he said, yeah, I've got a place. You can stay here. So it's my first place in LA. And he was playing with Oingo Boingo at the time.
Oh, okay.
So when I joined the Fibonacci's, you know, I was played in the demo tapes and stuff. He said, oh, Danny Elfman would love this. I'm going to play it for him. And he played it for Danny, and Danny did love it. And he said, I want to have you guys open for us on Halloween. Because they traditionally did a giant Halloween show.
And this
every
was
year.
The first album, too. It was like 81.
It was 81. Yeah. Yeah, 1981. Yeah. And actually, at the time, we hadn't recorded anything, like officially. Yeah.
Right.
We recorded that late in 89, in 81. Anyway, so we're going to open for Oingo Boingo at the Santa Monica Civic on this giant Halloween show. And so Danny said, well, you know, you guys are not going to get a sound check because it's a union hall and that's just the way it goes. But we have the exact same sound and we have the same sound guys. So why don't you open this show we're going to do, this private show at USC, and that'll be your sound check. And it was like 3 days before the big Halloween thing. So that sounded reasonable. It's like, great, okay. So we went to USC, and it was just in the auditorium or something.
It was in the main auditorium.
Like it was just for the school.
I think so, yeah.
And it was just, you know, whoever was not in class went to it.
It was in the evening.
Yeah, it was in the early evening. Yeah it was just.
I still have a poster from it that I tore off the wall because I enjoyed the show so much.
That's great.
I'd never heard. I had just arrived at school. It was my first year of college.
Well, that was cool.
And there was like free show down.
Did you even know Oingo Boingo?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
I knew nothing.
Yeah.
I came from San Diego listening to, you know, Devo, Blondie, the Ramones, and all that. Then I came up here, and of course, nobody at USC listened to any of that stuff. And then you guys and Oingo Boingo open. It's like, wow, music can sound like this. And I was so happy.
That's cool.
I remember
Ron
pointed at me, I think, and waved when I was going, yay.
Well, I think, we were pretty desperate for a kindred spirit at that point. Because the place was full of frat boys.
And that's what that place
was. They hated us.
Yeah.
Particularly Maggie. And, you know, Maggie, you know, for those that don't know, we had, or Maggie Song was the singer in the band, and she just could be very confrontational and sort of provocative.
That's why I
liked
her.
So, yeah, exactly, exactly. But this crowd, it just wasn't working. And Maggie happens to be Korean. That plays into this story because I'm sure you remember. So we're playing our set and we're just doing our normal thing and we're kind of as it progresses. Are we popping peas all over the place?
Well, I know about popping peas, but you have to kind of stay over the top of it or the levels do this.
Gotcha.
Because it's very directional.
Okay,
and also, you have to actually be within about probably 3 or 4 inches.
Is this good?
Yeah, that's great.
1, 2, okay. I'll try to be less enthusiastic.
I know it's kind of hard. I mean, I do this because then it just goes with me, and then plus it's like I've heard so many times where I'm doing this, and I'm like, okay, now I'm kind of like stuck to the microphone.
Yeah,
sorry. Go ahead.
So they hated us basically, and were shouting, you know, typical booing. But yeah, we were pelted with gym socks. And the funny thing is, Ron, the guitar player, he actually kept a pair because he's like, oh, I can use these. But Maggie was very kind of inspired by that, by an enthusiastic crowd, even if it's, you know, hate.
Yeah.
And so she was you know, egging them on. And at the end of the set, we had to abandon it probably halfway through because the chant from the crowd was, kill the yellow bitch. Kill the yellow bitch.
I don't remember that part.
Yeah, we remember it really well.
Okay, yeah.
So maybe for us it stuck out. Maybe it wasn't the whole room, but it felt like the whole room.
So I was down. I was way down front. I mean, I was probably in the second row over to your left over here somewhere.
Okay. But anyway,
I remember the feeling uneasy during that show.
It got kind of ugly. Yeah. It got ugly. So I think we bailed. And, you know, we didn't really finish our set, probably, because it was just getting ridiculous.
Yeah,
you know,
and then I had to just start combing the weekly to find out if you guys were playing again.
Right, and we were, because we played a lot back then, because the band had just started, really. But Danny was so embarrassed and apologetic, Danny Elfman. He felt really awful. He's like, oh, I'm so sorry. Because, you know, it's kind of like it's his crowd.
Yeah.
And he just felt awful when, you know, it wasn't his fault. But, you know, so then it's like, then a couple of days later, we have this big gig where there's probably 3,000 people at the Santa Monica Civic. And we were really a little bit concerned, you know, it's like, what's going to happen there? Because the USC thing
and
was...
And you wouldn't know that it would be a totally different crowd than USC. USC is a specific, you know, spoiled children crowd.
And it was fine. I mean, you know, we didn't we didn't exactly win the crowd over, but nobody hated us. They kind of like couldn't care less. It was, we were the opening band. You know, generally in a big place like that, you just get ignored. So it was fine. But
you need to do those things.
It was a good experience, and it's good for us to do that.
You know?
And anyway, that's the story on that. But I'm amazed that you were there. I'm amazed that any sort of sane, normal person. Oh, never mind. You were there.
No, well, to you and I, it's sane and normal.
Right, exactly.
Because I remember I started looking in the weekly, and then every once in a while, and a couple of my friends, yeah. I got to be fans too. Every once in a while, I'd see one that. See you guys listed, you know, way down by the bottom of the, you know, at the music machine or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I'd get on my little moped or scooter or what I have it at the time and ride to wherever the show was so I could see you guys. One time I saw you at the Chinese restaurant in in Chinatown. It was upstairs. It was a Chinese restaurant during the day. I think Club Ford Orchestra also played that.
Was it Madame Wong's?
I saw Madame Wong's, but there was a Chinatown Madame Wong's? Yeah, I remember the one at Santa Monica.
Yeah, there was a Chinatown. Actually, the Chinatown one, I think, was first.
Okay.
And then
it was upstairs
in a restaurant
or a restaurant during the day or something, and then they
right
had bands
at night.
Right
in that courtyard.
Yeah, exactly.
That was Madame Wong's, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Huh? Yeah.
And I just remember that, too.
Yeah, that was a great club, yeah. We should play... some Fibonacci's first because and we don't have to do it right now, but I'm saying
we don't have to.
People who are listening
we will get back
to
it.
What the hell are they talking about?
On this show I strive to get people to sort of follow along, but I don't make an extra effort
because
I'm not being paid for this. I'm doing it because I want to, and and if I'm having fun with the guest, I kind of forget that there's people listening, which is the way it should be.
It is the better way to go, yeah.
As I told Joe before we started here, I just this afternoon for a couple hours, I just sat down on my phone, actually, and typed out about 20 questions because the average on this show seems to be if I type out 20 questions, I'll either get through them or I won't. I've never run out.
Because
we just start talking about other stuff.
Yeah, it always spins off.
Have you been interviewed before? I mean, like, I mean, as a big, not for just an album, but for like, who's Joe? What has he been doing? How did he start out? All that stuff.
Almost most of it is attached to a group, you know.
Right. I'm going to try and attach you to three or four different groups tonight.
So it's for me to just be presented as me is great.
Okay, good.
But yeah, because it's always like with the group that I'm.
Right.
You know, like with the Fibs or Non-Credo or Double Knot Spy Car. You know, it's always like that.
Right.
So it's fun.
You know, the first thing I thought, I was like, how did you get started? But the thing is, I thought a better thing to ask would be, what's your earliest memory of an interest in music where you went, that's music and, you know, that's amazing to me?
Well, I have a really specific memory of my first interest in the music business. Which is maybe funnier. But the first records I had, I remember as a little, really little kid, less than five. My aunt, I grew up, I was born in New York, but we lived in Boston. My mom comes from a family of nine kids, so that I had tons of relatives. So one of my aunts bought me a box set of 7-inch, I mean, I kind of can still see it, 7-inch box set of singles of cowboy songs. And I loved it, you know. So it was like Roy Rogers.
Yeah.
And just, I don't know what specifically, but I remember Roy Rogers. I remember just like probably Gene Autry, whoever sang cowboy songs.
Yeah.
And that was my first recollection of records, you know, which became I'm a big record fiend. As most of us are.
Yeah.
But that sort of got me hooked on that. We had a little, you know, my mom had her records, whatever they were. I don't even remember.
So you'd plow through those.
You know, I had a little record player, and probably every day I would just listen to those 5-7-inch singles, whatever they were. And they probably were colored vinyl you know, how they did for kids. Because they were kind of made for kids, but it was great. So that was my first recollection of... And the thing is, I'm not a country music fan. I appreciate like the
music,
classic
but,
good country is good country. It's fine, but it didn't I don't have like a lifelong love of country music because of that. I just have a lifelong love of records and the object. And
yeah, yeah.
But so that's my first sort of feeling of music, you know, hearing music. But my first showbiz thing is kind of funny. When I was in kindergarten, so I was about five.
Yeah.
This was in Florida. We had moved to Florida. My the class had a it was a thing where you could take accordion. Like you would take accordion lessons.
Yeah.
So they started all the kids, you know, if you wanted to. So you know, I did.
Just to
I
give
guess,
you the fundamentals.
Or, yeah, you know, and which is weird now. I mean, I guess at the time accordion was
a big
kind of dates me, but accordion was a thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It quickly went away.
It wasn't ironic then. It was people
no,
were
not
learning.
At all. No. Well, you know, I guess I was the first hipster then because
yeah,
yeah. I was. I did it completely ironically as a 5 year old. You know. But so
there
so
with
anyway,
a smirk on your face.
I had. So I just took lessons, and I remember, you know, I think the guy came to our house probably, and I had this giant accordion. It felt like it was, you know, as big as me, which it probably was because I was five, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't remember actually knowing how to play it particularly, but the memory I have is, and I have photos of this event. They had a big end of year concert, so all the kids, like probably grades 1 through 5 or kindergarten through 5. We're going to participate in this probably like a Christmas show or something.
Yeah.
And so they told all the younger kids who really couldn't play, they said, just pretend like you're playing. Don't try to play. And the bigger kids will carry it.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that sounds reasonable. So I did. And
you
I don't
can't do that with an accordion. I guess you don't
well,
have to push
you
the,
just don't push the, yeah, I guess
keys.
That's what you did. I don't even know what I did particularly.
Yeah.
But after the concert, like the next class we had, it's like, okay, we're going to give a prize to the person who faked it the best. And so guess who won the prize? I got the prize, you know, because I was...
For air accordion.
For air accordion, for like miming accordion. And the prize was great. It was a box of those, you know what snowballs are, the cookies?
Yeah.
Like the big mound of white...
That pink
foam
stuff with
pink and then like coconut
yeah and
flakes
coconut on it that were probably not even real either.
I don't even know what any of it was, but I loved those when I was a kid. So
yeah.
That for me, that was like, well, this is incredible. So that was my first introduction to show business, and it's funny because I always think it's like, well, that kind of like the lesson there is like, it's not really how well you play, it's how well you look like you're playing,
how well you present yourself.
And
yes.
So that's my that's a real vivid memory of like. I mean, the prize is the most vivid memory.
Of course.
I can still see those. But yeah, so that's my first. That's a long-winded story, but I think it's kind of amazing.
No, well, we thrive on long-winded.
Yeah, okay,
that's
good.
What we want. Well, then, did you, you know, as you got older, did you start having favorite, like everybody does?
Well, yeah, I didn't stick with the accordion.
No.
Well, I'll tell you that right now. then I probably the next time I got involved in music, I was about 12. I started playing guitar, and then just listening to, you know, the rock bands of the, you know, the 60s rock bands.
Yeah.
You know, Beatles and Stones and Kinks. Love the Kinks. One of my first records was the Kinks' Greatest Hits. I still have it, you know. So I started playing guitar, and what's that?
I'm embarrassed. My first one was Elton John's Greatest Hits.
Well, that's all right too. Yeah.
Right. Actually, the first one was a Toccata and Fugue in D minor on harpsichord.
Wow.
Because I'd heard that and I thought, wow, I wonder what it would sound like on harpsichord. Or I saw it in the store. It's like, harpsichord, isn't it supposed to be on a organ or something? So I used my allowance money to buy that record. And then the second one was Elton John's Greatest Hits.
that's not bad though. Yeah, yeah. Well, you must have a thing for keyboards.
I don't know what I just have a thing for things that I like. I guess
I
don't know. I really
but both
don't.
Of those obviously the Bach and but Elton John piano player. You know, it's like
that's true. Right, you're right. I guess I just heard it on the radio. So
yeah, that's cool.
What'd you do? Just start playing along with the records?
Well, with guitar, yeah, I just started, you know, trying to learn chords, and I had a buddy. Down the street, he was, you know, rough, I think he was a year or two younger than me, but he had already been playing guitar because his older brother was a guitar player and was a musician, you know. So we kind of tried to learn together. And this kid was was more, you know, he had been playing about a year more than me, so that's a big deal.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're just starting out. But then the kid next door to me had a drum set, and I had an interest in drums. And I think at some point I acquired a pair of drumsticks. I think my sister got them from somebody at her school or whatever. And so I started to do the thing that every drummer I've ever talked to is just started playing on plastic garbage
pails,
you know,
yeah.
Garbage pails, yeah, small ones. And, you know, so you make a little drum set. And I was always fascinated with the look of a drummer, like in this all this stuff, like he has all these instruments, and yeah. You know, when you're a little kid, you
he's
don't know what they are, but
wall
you're just
in front of them.
It
know,
just right? seems really intriguing, like all this stuff around them. Yeah. What does that do? And you know, so I didn't know, but I just kind of made my version of a drum set with the, you know, the garbage pails, and so that's just, you know, pretty normal.
Yeah.
So I started banging on that, and I was playing guitar at the same time. And then the kid next door to me had a drum set, so I went over there. And, you know, it's like I had never tried a real drum set. It was really exciting. So can I try it? I did. And I found that I could kind of play a beat right away. You know,
uh-huh.
It's I guess because I had been playing on the pails, you know. So
the learning curve was not as steep for you for the drums.
No, yeah. No. I guess I, you know, sort of took to it. So I said, do you want to trade? I have an electric guitar. You want to trade your drums for the guitar? And he did.
Amazing.
Yeah, I was amazed. It's like, great. And so that was it. So I, you know, kind of never looked back. I still play guitar, you know, for fun.
Yeah.
I don't subject anybody else to it. But I it's funny because I've been thinking lately, I want to play kind of noise guitar in a band. You know, like find somebody to start a band with.
Just to play
just
noise?
Just to play. I mean, it doesn't have to be noise. I can actually play, you know. I can play, you know.
Well, you can't just start out playing noise not knowing how to play, because then it becomes very obvious very quickly that all you can play is noise.
Yeah, and I mean, it only worked for Ardo Lindsay, you know.
I don't know who
you
that
know
is.
Oh, okay. No. He was in that No Wave band. There you go.
That was a nice sound.
That was some noise.
Yeah.
DNA, the sort of no wave.
Okay,
know.
I've heard of them, yes.
You know, yeah.
I know who they are.
So he basically, I don't think he ever learned to really play. I've never heard him really play anything, you know, recognizably music, but
yeah.
He's amazing. He's great.
Okay, because you can be like Fred Frith or somebody and actually make it look like you're playing noise,
right.
But he's technically amazing,
you know,
and
Fred
he knows
Frith
what he's doing.
Is so, yeah, beyond,
yeah.
You know. But, right, yeah, you're right. But anyway, so I still like guitar a lot, and but I at a certain point, like in my college age, I started playing keyboard. So, but I played drums as a kid, you know. Just as soon as I started playing, I just, you know, fell in love, and that's all I wanted to do. So every day, come home from school and practice, you know. And it was not a chore at all.
And
you
your
know?
Parents put up with it.
Yeah, my mom was real supportive. You know, I mean.
Yeah.
So that worked out. My neighbors weren't quite as excited about the idea as I was, but you know.
Were you in the garage or in your
bedroom?
I was in
both. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
You know, our little rock combo, probably after about, you know, within a year or so, me and the kid down the street with the play guitar started a band. You know. So we practiced in my garage, and then I'd go back and forth between the bedroom and the garage. Yeah, it's garage rock.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had one in high school, too, and we were in various garages of different people his parents would get tired of it, so we come to my place, and then my parents would get tired of it, so we go to the next guy's place.
Yeah, so. That's how it works. and that whole cycle still goes on, you know, happily.
Yes.
Because a few years ago, probably about 5 or 6 years ago, I was giving drum lessons to kids kind of nearby in my neighborhood, and I had a whole bunch of them, just word of mouth. I would do these, like, two-day runs, like after school, and...
Uh-huh.
And it was great. And,
yeah.
You know, it was great extra income, but also it was kind of fun. And some of them had, a couple of them had their own bands, or like one girl's brother had, you know, he was an older brother, had his band, and they would play in the garage. And it's like, oh, yeah I used to do that too when I was your age. And it's kind of great to see it all these years later that it still goes on.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, it feels like a different world musically, like the technology and everything is so different.
Yeah. In fact, it kind of amazes me that there's people in garages playing instruments.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's like with all the technology and all the stuff that we couldn't even have imagined back then, people still just want to bang it out in the garage. So that's great. Yeah, it's cool.
Well, they must still want to play something, because otherwise they're going to be guitar-hooing it, and that's just, you know, faking it, but you're still doing something.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it, yeah. So that's, that was cool. That's good to, it was kind of nice to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, so then, so did you, because I know you went to Berkeley, right? Berkeley, well, L-E-E.
I went to the one in Boston, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I only went there for 1 year.
Okay.
So, I learned a lot of stuff, but I wasn't really into the idea of music school, you know.
Yeah. Like
I only stuck it out for 1 year.
Is it like, I have a writer friend, he writes for the SF Weekly, mm-hmm. and I think he used to have a magazine. Anyway, I was talking to him one time, and I said, you know, I'm kind of sorry I never went to journalism school. And he goes, don't be. I've never met a writer that's worth a shit that went to journalism school.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's certainly something to be said about that, yeah.
So sort of same thing. Well, I guess it depends on the person. But
yeah. I mean, it feels like, you know, as a non-journalist, that journalism school would be more, you'd get more out of it. And be able to apply it to the real world. Certainly with music, you know, you could, but you don't. I mean, I had already been playing for quite a long time, you know. So I had developed all my bad habits, I suppose. But I, you know, I'm completely self-taught. And uh-huh. even though I had a year of music classes, you
right.
know, it was... actually, drumming was not a big part of that year at Berkeley. Which was good. I mean, I studied.
What did they subject
studied,
you to?
Well, I studied
basic
just sort
stuff.
Of harmony, yeah, that kind of stuff, like yeah. basic harmony. And Berkeley was not like, you know, like MIT, the Musicians Institute. It was much more of a. It was kind of a cross between that kind of like almost trade school and a real music conservatory, but it wasn't that either, you know. So it was kind of in between.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, like I think of that. MI, they call it, Musicians Institute
yeah.
is kind of a trade school, you know. It's like a rock school or something.
Yeah,
there's nothing wrong with that, you know. It's cool, but so this was a little more. It wasn't formal at all, but it was a little more towards the formal. I had harmony and you know, and then some ensemble classes, which is really good because I had never played in anything other than rock bands, you know.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, I think I at the community college I played in the stage band, you know, but I didn't know how to, I couldn't read music or anything. I kind of started to learn then.
Yeah,
you know? But
well, I guess as a drummer and playing in garage bands, you don't really need to know.
Don't need
even,
to know.
Even the guitarist
not.
In a garage band doesn't need to know music.
Nobody
you
needs
just,
to
you
know
just play
anything.
By ear, yeah. by what you hear.
I mean, I play with guys or people that have been playing for 30 or 40 years that don't know how to read music, and it
uh-huh.
doesn't stop them at all. They're amazing musicians, you know, so yeah,
right.
it doesn't hurt you, you know. So in the course of whatever schooling I had, I did sort of learn how to read and, you know, and I actually enjoyed theory. I liked something about it. I guess I have sort of a mathematical mind, which I think you know, music is math oriented and certainly drumming and rhythm is math oriented, and I guess I have a decent aptitude towards math, so I kind of like that,
right?
You know, I like that part of it. So yeah, you know, but yeah, a year was enough schooling for me.
When did you move out here and why?
Well, I moved out in 81.
Right then.
Yeah, huh. That, like, the Fibs were my first sort of real band. I had joined a couple of crappy cover bands because I thought that's how that's how I used to make a living in Florida.
Okay.
I, like,
was just going to play paying gigs for,
yeah, yeah. I mean, I did play better stuff than, I mean, I my friend is a really good which seems kind of funny with the way I ended up, but he's a good blues player, and so I played in his band. We played just straight up blues.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly did my share of cover bands, you know, to make a living. So that doesn't really happen out here. I discovered in LA. It's not really
now. Not in LA.
It's really not now.
Everybody's very focused on going towards one thing here,
right? And so I thought, well, I'll move out there, and I want to do something, obviously, you know, better than that. That wasn't my goal, but to pay the rent, you know, I'll I play, and I'm a good player, so I'll find a good band that's working. And I quickly learned that, oh yeah, that doesn't really happen out here, you know.
Yeah, but, people did put ads in, like, the Weekly saying, you know, this kind of whatever, looking for this kind of musician to play this kind of music. That was going on then, wasn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah. People were always looking for musicians, but they weren't paying gigs. That's what I mean.
That's true.
That's what I mean. They weren't, like, I couldn't just go out and play, find a band to play gigs with. So I did a couple of, like I said, just crappy bands when I first moved out. And then I guess it was in the early fall... Late summer, I hooked up with the Fibonacci's and
in 81.
In 81,
like
yeah.
A couple months before I saw you.
Yeah. Oh, actually, that would have been one of the first gigs I did. I think the first gig I did was at the Whiskey, which was
was
a big deal. Yeah. And
it was probably a place you heard of. Everybody knew.
Yeah, absolutely. We opened for Sparks.
I was
just telling a friend about this the other night. It's funny.
Did one of the brothers like you, or was it a music industry thing?
No, the drummer liked us, and the drummer is now has since become a good friend of ours, who have known him since then. You know?
Uh-huh.
But David Kendrick, I don't know if you know him.
Yes,
but,
he played for Devo for a while.
Yeah, he played with Devo. Yeah. Well, he played with Sparks then, and he knew of the Fib, so he somehow, you know, he wasn't like a buddy then, but he just, I guess, kind of an acquaintance. But he got us on the gig. We played, I think it was two nights in a row at the Whiskey opening.
Wow. How did that crowd react?
Well, pretty good. We had some booze. We actually have a live cassette of that show.
Oh, my God.
Well, the first...
How many songs did you have at that point? 10 or 15 or something?
Yeah, we had about 15 songs, probably. Yeah. There's a little booing at the end. some light booing at the end of the set.
Yeah, but it's Sparks. But they're going to be sort of the most of the crowd's going to be okay with off the tracks.
Well, here's the thing though. That's what we thought, because for me, I'm like, it's like Come On to My House Sparks. That's Sparks to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and by the time the 80s came around, they kind of were doing dance, Euro dance, 80s dance music. So
exactly.
I think they had a K-Rock hit at the time. So,
they were
generating
like
a little bit of a different crowd.
Yeah.
You know, a little more straight ahead crowd.
Yeah, I guess so. Because you know what? Who used to hire them to play is frats at USC had them playing.
Seriously? Well, see, there you go.
I was walking by. Some friends of mine said, hey, you know, Sparks is playing a frat party. And I was like, what? So we went over there
did you
sneak through the fence and watched them. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
They were playing in a parking lot behind a frat.
Yeah. That's so funny. Well, see, there you go. Good for them. They cultivated a bigger audience. And as soon as you get a bigger audience... Yeah.
They were doing what they do. They weren't doing it to get the bigger audience, I don't think. I never got that from them. They were
not
just,
really.
They had kind of changed from what they did before.
Yeah, which is, you got to evolve. They were great. I mean, I remember, we were excited to see them, and they were not a disappointment. They sounded great.
Yeah.
It was fun, and, they're great. Stage presence is amazing, and I forget which is which, but the guy with the Hitler mustache.
Ron is the
Ron?
Hitler mustache,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he was doing his full-on shtick, like deadpan shtick.
Yeah, with his eyebrows and the whole bit.
Yeah, so it was just great to be there. And they weren't particularly friendly, the brothers, The band was great. They really liked the Fibs, and they were really, it's like, really glad to have you guys, thanks for doing it. And then the brothers kind of just ignored us, We were just an opening band. But whatever, that's fine.
They'd never heard of you, but
They never heard of us, and they didn't care to hear of us. So,
that's
for
too
us,
bad.
It was a
big deal.
Super great experience, and it was cool, and we earned some fans, out of that gig for sure. I mean, I talked to a handful of people that said, I saw you at the Whiskey with Sparks, and that's where I first, kind of like you're saying, you saw us at USC, this weird coincidental, just fell into your lap.
After that, every time I saw you guys, but you were the headliner, it wasn't like an opening thing, it was just kind of like, you were the listed band every time I saw you.
Yeah, because we would play smaller places that we could fill up. Yeah,
which is probably a total of about four or five times I saw the Fibonacci's. That's it.
Really?
Oh, yeah, okay. Because a lot of times I just couldn't get there.
Yeah. Right.
And I didn't know the bus system and all that. So I would, I was borrowing people's mopeds to get to your gigs and other
borrowing
music.
A moped.
Yes. Yeah. And then I got a Vespa and then I was able to ride to gigs, but none of the mod people would go to the Fibs gigs with me. So I'd go by myself.
Right. That would be a problem. Yeah. No, we didn't go over too well with the mod crowd.
No, probably not. That didn't work.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's funny. That reminds me of we did a thing for I think we taped New Wave Theater. Do you remember
that
show?
Yes, I linked it when I
it's on YouTube now.
Yeah.
Which was great. I mean, we had never seen it. A friend of ours sent us that just in the last couple of years, I think. We hadn't seen it in all those years, so it was really fun for us to see it. But when we taped that, they used to tape a bunch of different bands, you know, and I remember the Blasters were on the bill the night we taped our show, you know, our song.
They never had a theme. It was always just, here's some bands.
That was their theme.
Peter Ivers would just say, here's the next band.
Just a mishmash. That was what was great about it. And he asked every band, what is the meaning of life? You know, like,
is that
the most ridiculous, unanswerable question? That was, every band got asked.
Yeah.
That,
John said, I was afraid you'd ask that or something.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Terrible.
Cause we knew it was coming, you know. but the Blasters, obviously we have nothing in common with them except we play guitars, you know what I mean?
Right.
But they were really nice guys. But the one brother, I think it's Phil.
Was it Phil and Dave?
It's Phil and Dave. Yeah. And Phil is, I think, the older brother.
Yeah.
He came up to us, and he didn't say anything about the music. And he said, oh, the Fibonaccis, yeah. So you named yourself after the mathematician, right? And so he, as it turns out, he's actually a math whiz.
Oh.
and he was going off about Leonardo Fibonacci and his math theories, and it was spinning off into all this deep math stuff. He left us in the dust.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was really funny because, like, here's like, we're like this sort of like, you know, pretentious art rock band, and then you have this rootsy,
rockabilly kind of
rootsy band, and the guy from that band is getting all heady and mathing out and just leaving us in the math dust. It was really pretty funny. It was good.
Yeah, well, that sounds like he was nice about it.
He was really nice.
He was probably impressed.
He was nice.
Like, why would you name a band after a mathematician? That's one of the coolest things I ever heard.
And yeah, I think that was our connection with him, you know, with...
Yeah.
So that was cool. Yeah, it was great.
Well, why did you? Who came up with the name?
I
guess it was already established by the time
It was established by the time... I think Ron Stringer, but I could... It's either Ron or John, but I think it was Ron. Mm. Yeah. The band was called... I think there were several, you know, like 5-minute names, like
they all go. Everybody goes
like
through
the Velveeta Underground, and that was one of the rejected names. But for a minute, the band was called Smellbrain.
Yes, because that was your publishing.
And that's the name of that's what we called our publishing company after that name was retired as the band name. But yeah, it was actually, I think they actually played a gig or two as Smellbrain. Like the first gigs were Smellbrain, and then, and then became the Fibonaccis because that was a much better name.
Yes.
And much more commercial. But yeah, it's a great name, and it sort of fits the music, you know, the sound of the music, because we always thought it sounded like an Italian circus.
Yes,
family,
there's a lot of Nino Rota in it.
Yeah, and that's where, like, for us, it's not about the math end of it. It was more about just this sort of...
There
sounded
we go.
Like the yeah. There he is.
It'll
That's
get
not
closer.
Too bad. Yeah, here we come.
No, it gets quite loud.
Oh, good.
This is how people listening to the show know it's not fake. There he goes.
Yeah. Oh, there goes Greg and his sound effects.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people said you just have that on an effects thing. Yeah. So,
do you have any babies crying?
I should get some.
Yeah, just that sort of like it sounds like a trapeze act, you know, the Fibonaccis, the flying Fibonaccis. So that's what, that's what we liked about it. And that's the story on that. I think I would give Ron Stringer credit on that one. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, I talked to Ron once on the phone because I was writing a story for the Weekly when he was a editor.
Was he working there?
Music editor.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I called him.
He was actually the film editor.
Oh, is it film? Okay.
Yeah, he was the film editor. Yeah.
I was writing a story. I don't know if he was the editor for the story, but he answered the phone.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "This is Ron. This is Ron Stringer." I said, "Ron Stringer from the Fibonacci's?"
Oh, that's
great. Yeah. I said, "You're my favorite band ever, you guys. It was amazing. I got to talk to you." He's like, "Oh, God, you know, I didn't know we had fans anymore."
Yeah, that sounds like
he's a really nice guy on the phone.
He's a great guy. He's an amazing guy. Yeah.
Is he still around L.A.?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I think I have – he's a friend on Facebook. Actually, all of you are.
Yeah. Ron, he's barely on Facebook. He's actually not. He has a page, but I don't think he does anything.
Yeah, well, he's got more important things to do, I'm sure.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but, you know. No. You know, I don't know what he's doing for work, but he's not playing music. I mean, he plays clarinet for fun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
He doesn't play guitar. Because for years, we've been trying to do a reunion, you know. And
I wasn't going to bring this up till the end of the show.
Oh,
but
okay.
Well, part of my grand scheme is to somehow cajole you guys to do a show. Maybe even in here. I don't care.
Well,
you can do it in this room or properly on a stage somewhere in a club.
If it happens, we'll play anywhere because we just want to get out there and play. But, you know, I don't want to pin it on Ron, but he is one of the sort of main reasons we haven't been able to do it is because he doesn't play guitar and doesn't really have a lot of desire to pick it up. And
We'll have to conspire and think of something to
something
give him a good
like
incentive
that, you know, is just irresistible. Yeah. I don't even know if that would do it. I'm not sure what it would take. But the funny thing is, it's almost the same as when the band started. I mean, I wasn't there, but when the band started, Ron was not interested at all in playing music. And they had to cajole him, and they had to, like, literally drag him on stage for the first gig. And I think he...
But he was so good at it.
He was great. But
everybody
but
in
he
the
was,
band was so focused on the on what they were doing.
But Ron, he would get pretty nervous on stage. You know, he's one of those kinds of musicians. And he's a great musical mind, though. I mean, he's amazing. You know, it's just like his musicality. But he just didn't perform. He's just kind of nervous, a nervous performer.
Yeah.
So he never, I mean, he'd be the kind of like, you know, you're waiting in the wings to go on. And he's the kind of guy that's like, he's doing everything he can to not run, just go running down the street screaming. You know, he's just freaking out the whole
time.
How
did he feel when you have gym socks thrown at you and people boo at you?
You know, the thing about that kind of stuff is most of the time, once you go on stage...
Yeah, it's kind of like jumping out of the plane.
Yeah, you're okay.
You're there.
You're okay, but it's that... I've experienced it too. I mean, I don't get nervous before gigs because I just played so many gigs.
It's, exactly.
But still, there's certain moments where, you know, I know what that feels like. And
a lot of times it'll just come out of nowhere.
It's right before you have to do it.
Yeah.
And the minute you go on, you're fine, you know, because you have a job. You have a you can't have those thoughts in your head, or you're going to have a breakdown on stage. And that what would be more embarrassing than that? you know what I mean. So
I've done public speaking the first 10 or 20 times. I'm like, yeah.
See,
and after that, you're just kind of like, whatever. And then every once in a while, you go, I have no idea what I'm doing. Then you get pushed out there anyway, and you're fine.
See, for me, the thought of if I had to go out and do a TED talk, I'm waiting for them to ask me for that. No, I wouldn't be able to do that. I can't imagine doing that. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah,
just
I
standing
do.
There
because
in front
you're
of a,
because you've got the your communication is through playing, and you've got a thing there, and you've got a prop, and you've got something you can actually. I'm not saying hide behind.
I need a barrier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. Exactly.
Well, and I'd go up and sit on the podium like this, you know.
But. Yeah, right. I guess if I was sitting behind a drum kit, I could probably do it easier, even if I didn't have to play, you know. It's like that would probably help. But, I would be petrified if I had to, like public speaking, yeah.
Do you want to play a Fibonacci tune or two? And then we can move on to the next thing. We have plenty of time.
Okay.
I don't know when you have to leave. I do not have a show after me. So if we run over, I don't care.
All right. Well, let's...
And I haven't used a CD player here in probably
years. Let's fire it up.
Let's see if it works. And we've got two different ones, so I think this is the main one that they usually use.
Okay. I think the song...
Yeah, so I have this too.
I would suggest play...
The funny thing is, it doesn't have the original versions of a couple things on it, like the album versions, which is kind of strange.
I can explain why, but...
Let's just play something.
Let's not, yeah. Let's play... Oh, God, what number is it? This is the song that... this is for all the USC frat boys who are probably like high-powered retiring attorneys right now. Track 11. There you go.
Ah, okay. I love this one.
Oh,
Wow, I wonder what that was. No? This is a demo that I got off the Fibonacci site that... It's not the CD. I got this off the site that John Gentino runs. Yeah. Oh, there we go. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Here we go.
There you go.
Whoops.
Yeah, I still have the vinyl you gave me of the first EP.
I gave you that?
Yes. Oh, I came over to your place, your apartment, sometime in the, I think, the late 80s or early 90s. I don't know how I got in touch with you. And you said, well, here's an extra one. You can have this one. I was like, because I'd never even seen one. And that's what had Second Coming on it, which we didn't play.
Yeah, it did.
Okay, you know what?
The night's still young. Yes. What time is it?
It is almost 9.
Yeah.
Like I said, we could stay as late as we want.
Well, that was generous of me.
Yes, it was. And then I think I found another copy years later somewhere.
Really?
And I think I sold it on eBay because it was exceedingly rare.
Yeah.
Because I had two. I mean, what am I going to do with two? So I kept the one that had the nicer cover and the thing was in nice condition. And
oh, good. Yeah.
The other thing I found online was on YouTube was Art Life, which was only on the Slam Dance soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. That's a terrible version. I think. I don't know.
That's the only one I know because it's the only one I've ever heard.
We did an early version of that. It's better than what came out. But anyway,
I have played Second Coming on my show many times, and in fact, we will move on. But I had a magazine called The Excluded Middle in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first issue I printed the lyrics to Second Coming.
Oh, really?
Yeah, just because I liked it so much. And it's like, this is the only song I know of that deals with this kind of theme, so I printed it.
Right.
If people don't know, it's a song about wanting or getting contact with some kind of alien civilization.
Yeah, yeah. The Second Coming of our lords and master.
Yeah, exactly. So the what happened with the Fibonacci's? That they, I think what I heard was, you know, record company stuff, not a lot of support, and then finally screw this because we want to take it to the next level and we can't.
That kind of sums it up in a way. The first thing that happened was Ron quit the band.
Oh,
you know, we started out as a four piece. We never had a bass player, and then at a certain point. We wanted a bass player because I think we thought we should be more like a rock band.
Yeah. You know?
So we got a bass player, and then
who was that? Was that Tom?
That was Tom. Tom Corey.
Corey.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Cornblatt, as we used to call him, affectionately. And so then the years I'm not sure about, but at a certain point Ron just didn't want to do it anymore. He didn't want to do it from the beginning, so he was being dragged along, and then he didn't want to do it, so he quit. And
that's too bad.
Yeah, it was too bad. So then Tom kind of played guitar, so he kind of went back and forth, but he's filled the gap. We never replaced Ron.
Right.
But Tom would do half guitar. As a matter of fact, that last song you played, Friends of Crime, is Tom on guitar.
Okay.
Yeah,
yeah, we should have back announced. It was Friends of Crime from the Terrorvision soundtrack. And then the theme from Terrorvision. Just the Terrorvision.
It's called Terrorvision. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the first song was called Rice Song.
Yes.
And that's Maggie singing in Korean.
I never knew she was actually singing Korean. I thought she was just saying gibberish for the sake of saying gibberish.
No,
but she wasn't.
It's Korean. Yeah, it's Korean. That's the one that the USC boys really loved.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, okay, so that was why.
Yeah. Sorry, but anyway, so Ron left, and then we continued with Tom filling the gap, and I don't know. I think the beginning of it changed, the band changed, you know, because personnel, I mean, especially a band like that, it's about the individual people in it and they make up the sound, you know?
Yeah.
So when one person leaves or changes, things are going to change. And I don't know, it just kind of ran its course. I would say, you know,
yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of sort of some business stuff. There was, you know, luckily or unluckily, we weren't successful enough from a business point of view to have a lot of those kind of problems that bands have, like money problems. We had our own little minor versions of that.
Yeah.
You know, but, yeah. You know, no big deals where the band hates each other because this person
right.
screwed that person over.
Right,
or,
right.
You know, we never had that much. We never had money to worry about.
It was kind of directed outwards towards the music industry. At least that's all I'd heard. And it was probably partially true and partially not.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of had a sort of peak where it seemed like we could take a step up the ladder, the music business ladder. And I think that didn't quite happen. So then what do you do? You know, we probably should have gone backwards and just been more of an art band, you know, but it was probably too late to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Hmm.
But, so it actually was, I don't know, 6 years or so, which 6 or 7 years, which
that's
is,
a good run for a band.
That's not a bad run. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it seems short now, but it's not bad, you know?
No.
I mean, we didn't put out a ton of stuff either. We only put out 2 EPs and a full-length LP and then the soundtrack stuff.
Yeah.
And scattered pieces. So we didn't, you know, in 6 years, it's not like we put out 6 records. Some people do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I put out 9 magazines in 9 years. That's how long it took.
Really?
Well, not me. I had friends on the first 3 or 4, and then after that, I did it myself.
Right.
But yeah, and then you get to a place where I guess that's the run, and that's where it ends.
Yeah. Well, right. Yeah. Yeah.
Were you doing other stuff during the Fibonacci stuff? Other music?
Actually, not a lot. I would do some things. Like sometimes somebody would ask me to play or something. I would do like a side project, you know, I remember, just playing with some friends, but nothing really serious. And because we were pretty, and especially in the early first like 3 years, we were pretty busy. We just rehearsed all the time. We actually were pretty hardworking.
Yeah.
You know, we had a pretty good work ethic. We'd show up at the rehearsal room and play, and we just bang it out.
Well, there's your problem there. Everybody was very
exactly.
They were very serious about it,
right? I didn't need to do other stuff. But that after, you know, I think as the band went on, and I think I started doing other things. And actually, like Kira and I started doing stuff together at the. I don't remember the. Kind of the end of the run with the Fibs, you know, and that also kind of coincided with when I started playing with Stan Ridgway.
Yeah, I was going to ask because the next time I heard of you, you were playing for Stan. I said, "Hey, wait, that's Joe that was playing."
Yeah,
with
I actually, it's funny to think that I played with Stan so early, but I actually was in doing both things at the end of the Fibs run and the beginning of Stan's run. There was some overlap. Yeah. And then, so after the band was done, that's when Kira and I started our project, which is called Non Creator, which we still do. That started, you know, sort of like for me, that was my next creative outlet, you know. And so it worked out really nicely because then I had this other thing that was even better in terms of creatively for me because I had an opportunity to write more, you know, be involved more in the writing.
Right.
I mean, the Fibs, you know, I would write a few little things and we would arrange the music together as a group, you know, it's all group arranged, but Ron and John were just so good. Their writing was so good that, you know, they didn't need anybody else. It was kind of like, you know, maybe it's a terrible analogy, but the Beatles, you know, like they had 2 amazing writers. So someone like George Harrison, I'm not saying I'm the George Harrison of the group. I'm still Ringo, but, no, you know what I mean? Like it's, you could be a decent writer, but it's tough to squeeze into that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So John and Ron were good together, you know, they came up with some really interesting stuff. So, you know, I didn't really write much from scratch for the band. So once the band was done and I teamed up with Kira, then I had that outlet to write more. And so that was, I was really happy with that.
You're actually playing some different instruments,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and I didn't... Yeah, because we weren't so much a... Well, we weren't a band. It was just the two of us recording at home, you know, piece by piece. So it wasn't as a band thing, so it wasn't as drum set focused.
Right.
So I could play keyboards and have lots of stuff from the first record on. There's no drums at all. You know, it's kind of keyboard oriented. And Kira plays keyboards and bass and clarinets and lots of other things too. So for both of us, it was this outlet to sort of tap into that multi-instrumental thing that we were interested in that. So yeah, that you know, from a creative point of view, it was satisfying. You know, I didn't feel the loss of the fibs in creatively, you know, because I went right into Non-Credo. Yeah,
right.
Dead air. You never have dead air on the radio.
Oh, I always do. Constantly. You know, no. But what I was going to do is, do you have any Non-Credo?
Do you
want to play?
I have everything.
I went through a bunch of the stuff over the last couple of days, and my favorite one, strangely enough, don't say anything about me. Don't think anything about me. Was the Thank You, Mommy?
Oh, really?
What about the where Kira's singing about her mom, just making her life hell, and thank you so much.
That's a good. Hang on. Let me find that. That's a really interesting start, because
that's an early
that was one
early
of the
on,
first
right?
the first things that we did together at all. Uh-huh. Know, it was her song, and it really started out. She was just recording her music and had me play on it, you know, and that shortly after turned into Non-Credo. But we weren't called that at that time. It was just Kira's song. So so this is like almost the first. You call it the first Non-Credo tune.
What track is it on here?
I'm trying to see. It's track 9.
Oh, 9. Wow.
Yeah.
So,
this is called Thank You, Mommy. And, you can... It's, it's self-explanatory.
Yes, it is. As you get into it. Let's see if this CD player is still working. Here we go.
Your face. That is for being seen with me in public. Deliberately dressed like a disgrace.
There we go. That was Thank You, Mommy. Off. That was the first album, right?
That is the first album called Reluctant Hosts. And that's a true story.
Of course it is. Otherwise, you wouldn't. Why would you write it if it wasn't true?
Well, you know, I have a vivid imagination. Let's play this song. This is from the second record we did called Happy Wretched Family.
And it is track
this
number?
Is, yeah, let me see. Track 4.
Ah, okay. That was a quick one. Yeah. Do you want to front load it or do you just want to play it?
This is it's called Piano Urine, and it's written from a dream that Kira had. She wrote the lyrics, and we'll listen to it. And I mean, I'm not going to try to explain it, but it involves
that's usually best.
It involves extraterrestrials and maybe a desire for a mouthless race. I don't know.
Thank you. Magnolia. And it wasn't just the face. Though much as I wish there was one, I've never seen a mouth this face. It had something to do with the packets and seeds and pods on the wall. Hieroglyphics fill in the spaces that are wide and 50 tall. I is a big
one, that's my gift.
I thought
I did not
Hey, Joe, what was the name of that
hey,
one?
That song's called Piano Urine.
That's right. You said beforehand.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So we're back announcing, too.
Yeah, yeah. That's from our hit record, Happy Wretched Family.
How does Noncredo do? And how are your sales? Not that I guess you really care that much, but...
Well,
you care. You always
like,
care.
We like to care, yeah.
Yes.
Sure. Well, you know, we... well, now, you know, you can... You get... We have all our stuff on CD Baby.
Right.
So you, they give you a really good accounting. So you can see... I mean, we don't sell very many physical discs anymore. I don't think anybody does, you know?
But, no, but people can, you know...
But so you can
buy
sell
a track
download,
or the whole
the
thing.
Download, the downloads. But then now they give you the accounting of the streaming. So we get to see...
Oh,
I don't
if
even
people
know.
Are just even previewing and how
yeah,
much.
Yeah, or like Spotify, you know. So we get those reports. And, you know, it's not plentiful, but I don't even know how many zeros are after the decimal point. It's like 0.00001
for each stream.
Yeah.
Oh, for a stream, not
for each stream.
If people actually purchase, it's a little bit better.
Yeah, it's better. It's much better.
Especially CD Baby, which is not it's not Apple and it's not Amazon. So.
Right. But they handle all that stuff, so which is good. So all the stuff is available on iTunes, and which is, you know, that's where everybody goes. Of course, now everything's changing, and it's going to be all streaming, Apple Music, it's sort of, there's always something going on, and one day we'll get a report that you sold a record, or you sold a download of your album, you know. That's always nice.
Yeah.
But, it's very, it's hard. Yeah, it's pretty hard. But you know.
How often do you play live? Because you are playing live coming up this Saturday.
That's right.
There's a good
are,
segue.
What beautiful. That's so strictly profesh. Yeah, we don't play live often at all. But in the last, I'd say the last 6 months to a year, we have a new band that we put together. It's me and Kira, and I've been playing keyboards. And Kira does what she does, which is sing. And she's not really playing keyboard. She does play some like bells and like glockenspiel type thing. But she sings and plays bass clarinet and bass guitar. But we have an upright bass player and a trombone player, and these great twin brothers, the Alvidrez twins, Michael and Carlos. They have been playing with us, and we just love working with them. They're great musicians. They're really fun guys. They like the music. They're willing to come along for the ride. So, you know, it's been cool. So we have a band that we enjoy working with, and we can play a lot more material, because before that it was just me and Kira going out. And we did stuff from our CD called Improper, which was an improvised opera, And and that involved...
The one that has the Japanese-looking lady on the back cover.
Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. that's a painting by this kind of well-known guy, Alec Gross. He's a really good painter.
Never heard of him.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, but he's... anyway, we just like the image, so we used it. But... anyway, we were just doing the duo, and it was much more sort of, we weren't doing our song, like we didn't do much material, or we didn't do any material from the older records, because it was just the two of us. I mean, we do a few, but now we feel like we can do more stuff, plus the new stuff we are coming up with is... we can arrange it for this ensemble.
Right. Yeah.
So we can pull it off live. That's the problem with a lot of this stuff, is that we can't really play it live, without a 6-piece band.
Yeah.
And when we first were playing, I think we had as much as 6 people, and we thought, that's how we're going to have to do it. And that quickly becomes old, because you just can't, unless you have a big bag of money to pay people,
you can't get
6 people
that.
In the room, to do gigs. It's just
not unless they're 20somethings and they're
right.
just going to do it.
Right, exactly.
And they're not going to play this kind of stuff, I don't think.
No, that's the other thing. It's hard because it does require a certain level of
proficiency.
Yeah. It's not naive, really. Although it maybe sounds like it to some people, I don't know. But
well, then they're not listening.
Yeah, right. But so anyway, we're playing. We've been playing more, and we played at Cafe Nela. I don't know if you know that place in Cypress
Park. I've heard
of
it, but I haven't been there yet.
It's a cool place. We played there 2 or 3 times. That's kind of Double Knot Spy Car's home away from home too.
Okay. So I've only seen you at Tex.
At Tex, yeah.
Tex, Tex, whatever.
Well, they call it Tex, actually. And
okay.
Most everybody says Tay or Takes. Or
yeah, I guess it, I don't
T-A-I-X,
know.
But
yeah.
We asked some Frenchies and they say Tay. And it's a family name, so it's...
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Anything goes. So it's Tex. Anyway.
Makes sense. French.
Yeah, it's French, yeah. So Cafe Nela has been a cool place, but we have a gig on Saturday at this place in Altadena called the Folly Bowl, and it's amazing. These artists have they live in the top of the hill in the foothills of the foothills of Altadena, and they have this nice house at the top of the hill, and they built out their garden, terrace garden down the hill.
Are they near,
and at the bottom,
what is it?
I know, Zorthian.
Yeah.
I don't know how how near it is to that. It's, I mean, it's up in the foothills.
I've never seen that place until this year, about 2 months
ago. I think that's a few miles west of where this place is.
So it's a space, or is
it's a home. It's their home, and
private,
it's
residence.
Their backyard. Yeah, okay. It's a private residence, and they every summer they do a series of shows. They probably do 4 to 6 shows through the summer, and it's just beautiful. They've made this amphitheater, and so there's this stage at the bottom of the, which is at ground level, and then it goes up, and you bring bring cushions to sit on, and they have these sort of stone seats that they've made, and they encourage you to bring food, and like make a picnic of it, bring wine and whatever you want to do, and so it's just great. So it's this beautiful summer outdoor event, so we're doing that on Saturday. It's, I mean, if your listeners are interested, yeah, it starts at 7.
Okay.
And
can they find out about it on the
site? Yeah, on our Facebook page.
Okay.
Is the best way. So if you go to Facebook and just look up Non Credo, NONCREDO, you'll find our page, and then we have the links to the gig. And we're playing also with, pretty excited because Frank is on the bill. You remember Frank?
Yes.
PH.
When I saw that, I was like,
Frank,
she's still around?
Yeah, I know.
That's great.
I mean, I didn't know she's... I mean, I knew she was around, but I didn't know... I hadn't seen her playing.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen that she was playing. And,
right.
And so it's like, oh, we're going to get Frank on. It's like, yes, that would be really cool. So so we're happy about that. And it'll be cool because it's... we both kind of come from... Like, Frank is from the late 70s. I mean, she's been around a long time. So we both come from the same world.
Yeah, she was well established when I first heard of her in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah. So she had a head start on us on the Fibonacci's, but I feel like we kind of grew up together,
Yeah,
it's part of the clan. So that'll be cool to see her. But yeah, it's a really great space and just beautiful, and it'll be a lot of fun. So anybody interested,
what time does that start?
They want people to get there at 7, and then the music starts at 7:30.
Okay.
So Frank,
I'm
gonna
be in San Diego and see if I can get away in
really?
Time to make it. Yeah,
Frank will start at 7:30, and then we'll play like an hour later.
Okay.
8:30 to 9:30, something like that. Yeah, it's cool. If you can make it, you should try, because it's well
I'd
worth
like
it.
And
it's They don't. It's not like an admission. They just suggest a donation, like $10, $15.
Right.
But if you're broke, then you just bring a bottle of wine and get drunk and go home.
I'll give you some of my unemployment money.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. We'll take a piece of that government action. yeah. So it's just a great scene. Yeah. So we're doing that, and we'll be around more. We have this band that we like playing with, and so we've been having fun doing gigs. It's not always been fun, it's kind of sometimes more of a chore than anything. But
it's cool now. Yeah, anything goes through phases like that.
Yeah,
then you hit that plateau, and you're like, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that's it. Thanks for bringing that up, because that's the job of doing a radio show, is plugging.
Yeah, partially.
Yeah.
I guess the other part of it, which is the more important part of it, is having fun doing it. So, which I try to
that
do.
That we've accomplished already.
We try to do on this show. Yeah, I told
Joe earlier.
I can't
speak for the listeners.
Like, yeah,
but
we're
having
fun. Yeah, I told Joe earlier. It's like, I hope I'm not, because I've never interviewed about music or anything like this, and so I feel kind of nervous. Like, shut up! I'm having fun. So that's
yeah,
cool.
That's great. Yeah.
A little earlier, right while we were playing that Non Credo, you said, "I said." Do you have other music in there that you like?
Which right.
I
said yeah.
Either stuff that you're into, or stuff that influenced you, or you think people would be it would be very bad if they did not know about it.
Well, there's a lot of that. influence is good. I did bring a few things. Let's play this. This, if we play nothing else, we got to play this.
Okay.
This is one of me and Kira's favorite pieces of music. This is a group called Aksak Mabul. They're Belgium. These two guys. You never
heard of them. Oh, okay. Not at all.
Oh, it's
and I'm being totally honest on this show. If I haven't heard of something.
Yeah. No,
in fact,
no,
I've started this new thing in my life a couple years ago. If I don't know about something, I'm going to tell you I don't know about it because I might learn something. Anyway, which track would you like me to play?
Track one. This is called A Modern Lesson, and it has a bunch of favorites like Chris Cutler, Fred Frith.
Yeah,
they're on that. Most of these songs, but it's just amazing, and it's a take on Bo Diddley.
Yeah. Ah.
We'll be right back.
Just gonna let it fade.
That was Aksak Mabul.
From Belgium.
They are from Belgium.
Are they still active?
Well,
in some form?
Yeah, actually they are because of this. This is another brilliant segue we're doing here. This this is the new Aksak Mabul. That record that we just that song we just heard was copyright 1980.
Yeah.
So it's been around for a while. But this one just came out last year or this year maybe. It's as they call it, the unfinished avant pop album, 1983. This came out on Cram Disc. The stuff that they did back then with the singer from this other Belgian band, the Honeymoon Killers. Her name is Veronique Vincent, and she collaborated with Aksak Mabul. I think she had sung on some of their tunes, and they played on some of hers. Anyway, this is the thing that they did 30 years ago, and then they went back to it now, finished it, and put it out. So we'll check that out.
Je parie.
So that was?
Yeah, that's Véronique Vincent and Aksak Mabul with the Honeymoon Killers. It's from their new CD. It's actually a CD. Yeah, it was recorded in the 80s, and they finally finished it up and put it out, and it's great.
It doesn't sound more, like it doesn't sound like 80s. It doesn't sound like now. It is unhooked from time.
It is. You're right. Absolutely, which is great. It's hard to do that. It's hard to pull that off.
It's very hard.
This is much more sort of French poppy compared to the first thing we played, which is grittier more art band.
Well, yeah, she has that yay sound.
Yeah,
kind of
exactly.
Voice going.
Yeah, which I love. So
me too.
I'm a sucker for that.
Me too.
So that the original Aksak Mabul, that was a big influence on us. Like we just loved that stuff. So
do they know about your stuff? Have you sent them anything?
I've been in contact with them now because of Facebook. You can get in touch with everybody in the world, which is great.
Yeah.
Really cool. And I don't remember what I sent. I think I sent them the new Double Knot Spy Car.
Uh-huh. Which we will talk about here in a minute.
Because I had a link that they could that had a stream. But I should send them that. I haven't, I've been sort of hesitant to jump in like
Yes,
that.
I know.
You know how that is.
Yes, I know exactly how that is. I'm very nervous to talk to people.
It was pertinent to...
It's like, what if they don't like it?
Yeah, they're sort of forcing, unsolicited, listen to my band, I mean, they would like it, but I don't know. I'm just more...
Just send them a couple of tracks.
Yeah, exactly.
The other band that Joe is involved with, which is... quite a popular band. It's been how long have you been going? Double Knot Spy Car since the late 90s?
It's been going since I joined about 12 or 13 or more years ago. Yeah.
Sort of near the beginning. Not too long after.
I think they had been together for 4 or 5 years though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's going on 20 years.
Go ahead.
But yeah, this band, Double Knot Spy Car, we've been really active because it's very much a playing band, it's a live band kind of thing. So we play quite a bit. We have, like I mentioned earlier, we play a lot at Cafe Nela. Like we just did a residency in May. We played every Thursday, and we're doing the same thing in October, every Thursday at that club. And it's cool too because they give us the whole night, so we book two other bands or whatever. So we use it as a way to bring in,
showcase people.
Yeah, like or hear people like that we've heard about, but it's like, what do they sound like live? Let's book them and find out, it's cool now because you can hear some, you discover a band on Facebook or wherever, online. And you like the way they sound, and if they're local, you can just have them come and play. Yeah. And we found some really cool bands that way. So, it makes for a fun night, and we try to mix it up. Like not that anybody does, but we're not really interested in finding bands that sound like us.
Right.
We want things that don't sound like us. So,
yeah.
to make a night of it. So it's cool, but.
I understand the selfish urge in presenting things.
Yeah, right. But this band, so the deal with Double Knot Spy Car is it's kind of a guitar-based instrumental band, two guitars, bass, and drums.
How do people describe it? I guess how would you describe it? But
I'm particularly bad at describing. Like if you ask me, because people ask all the time, non-credo. Well, people ask, what is non-credo? How do you describe that music? And I'm at a complete loss.
Like this, and then you put on headphones and you play it.
Well, that's the best way. Yeah, you carry around. I guess you could just pull
out
your phone.
Maybe we'll do that with Double Knot Spy Car too.
But Double Knot Spy Car is a little easier. We actually use genres as a sort of compositional tool. So. You know what I mean? Like
basically, throwing them in a blender and seeing what comes out of that.
Yeah, like it's like, let's write a bossa nova, And so it sort of twisted, unusual version of it will come out. But I had to say...
These guys are all, like, working musicians, have been working for a while and are very good at what they do. So
yeah, everybody's a good accomplished player, so we can do a lot of stuff. And this is everybody's outlet, you know, more creative outlet, you know, musically. So, but I always say it's kind of surf spy, but beyond that, because that's very specific.
There's a lot of other stuff coming in,
but
besides
there's so
that.
Much. You know,
but to open the door, I guess you would say
that would open the door, and then you know, okay, think Ennio Morricone.
Yes,
You know, got to throw in that, which is.
And not just the Western stuff, some other Morricone.
No, like the detective stuff, and I brought some Morricone.
Oh, okay, good.
We can maybe if we get to it, but
it was so horrible when he broke his leg and he couldn't. Remember, he was gonna,
he was going to be here.
I had tickets for that, and everybody went.
Was that last year?
Yeah, it was last year.
You had tickets.
Yeah,
oh, it's great.
And that it took a while, but I got the money back. And he's apparently scoring the Tarantino movie. The new.
I saw that somewhere real briefly. I think. Yeah, I saw that.
It's amazing to think that Ennio Morricone would be scoring a Tarantino movie. It just doesn't seem like the timelines work.
No, that's true. But creatively, it makes perfect sense. But Tarantino's kind of used stuff from Morricone. I think reused it from other films anyway. So he should start from scratch and do it right. So I think that'll be cool. Yeah. But I mean, you know, Double Knot Spy Car should score a Tarantino film as well.
Yes, they should.
You know, definitely.
I think they have, but has Double Knot done any TV movie scoring stuff?
We have.
Because it seems obvious to me when you hear it.
Yeah,
hear
I mean, it's very soundtrack influenced and very atmospheric and evocative of a certain thing. Before I joined the band, they had done at least one or two kind of short films or, you know, like really low budget films. Nothing that I can say, oh, it's this and this. But and then since I've been in the band, we haven't done a full on score, but we've had songs used in film or TV stuff that, you know, just songs that we've already got.
Yeah.
That wasn't composed for the picture. But and then what else have we done? Yeah, just real small stuff. I mean, nowadays, that's kind of the only way a band can make money is licensing.
Yeah.
You know, like you can do okay, I guess, if you do. It's kind of, it's a little tricky because the film people want stuff for free. And
what a surprise.
You know, yeah, exactly. But, you know, they don't, it's like, well, we don't have any budget for music. And it's like, well, yeah, that's because you paid everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you think ahead, you should budget that. And then,
Music should all be free because it's, you know. I can get it online by stealing it, and
So it's now they want to, you know, it's exposure, as they put it. you know, a lot of people are going to hear your song. It's like, well, great, but what ultimately is that going to get us? But there's people that understand that the old way that it used to work is a valid way to work. You know, and they'll pay you, you know, a little bit.
Yeah,
what they can.
Somebody said freelance should be called paylance.
that's a good point. It's like that. It's a bad term, freelance.
Because it has that word in it.
Yeah, you put the free in freelance.
What do you want to play from Double Knot? I had three or four requests, but what do you want to play? And then we'll get to mine. And one of them was the same.
Well, yeah, let's play that. Do you have it there, or do you want to do it from the CD?
Probably do it from the CD.
Okay.
Probably sound better.
You know, this is our new, the newest thing we did. It's kind of got a little interesting story, and
I can relate first. Yeah, please do.
I think it's good to set it up a little bit. This is a collaboration with Double Knot Spy Car and Stu, the singer-songwriter, who was an L.A. guy. You got the track number?
3.
Yeah. Perfect. And he now lives in New York. He's branched out into musical theater and done really well with that. But he used to have a band called The Negro Problem, an amazing band, and he's an amazing singer and songwriter. Anyway, we did this project that Paul Lax, the guitarist, slap steel player, put together had the idea for, where we would go into the studio and improvise for like a couple of days without any preparation, completely free improv. Stu had some lyrics written down, you know, like he just had some, had a notebook with some words.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it was completely.
He actually had that notebook with him.
Well, that was Greg Franco.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That was a different guy. We did some of these songs with, because Stu's in New York. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, we did some of these songs with a good friend of ours, Greg Franco. But when we did it in the studio, yeah, he just had you know, vague idea of the words, and we just went for it for a couple of days. And we ended up with hours of material. And Mark took it home and whittled it down to listenable form. And then we proceeded to basically sit on it for 10 years. I mean, we did this 10 years ago.
What?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and for various reasons, we could never get it together to release it. And we all loved it. It's like, this is great. This is, like, amazing, and we got to put this out. But it just never happened until finally about a year and a half ago, and it took us that long to, you know, it takes a long time to get things out.
Yeah.
But we're really happy finally it's out. And we have a CD, and we actually did vinyl, which took 6 months to manufacture. It's crazy.
Is that hard now?
Yeah, it's a rough
out there. I figured it'd be slightly easier now because there's this weird, like, you know, last year or two bump in vinyl coolness.
That's why you can't.
Oh, because it's backed up and there's only a few people.
Yeah. And the pressing plant told us, he said, we don't bump people. That's just the waiting line to get it done. So it took 6 months. So we just got the vinyl 2 weeks ago, you know. We've had the CD for 6 months. But we're really happy with it. It's really good stuff. It's different than a Spy Car record, and it's different than a Stu record. It's really got its own kind of thing. Anyway, that's the backstory on how this was done. And, you know, we'll play it. And like you say, how do you describe it? Well, here's how you play it.
What's this one called?
This one's called Marcy Beaucoup. And it's about a Francophile, American Francophile in Paris. And another American guy meets her and is looking, maybe they're looking for different things out of the French experience. She was sad, she'd been born a Yank. Asked me, could she read some Rambo? I said, knock yourself out, but baby, I gotta go. You know I need some action at nature's insistence. I'm trying to break through this funky French resistance. Environment in the metro, dancing to that retro. Environment in the metro, I'm dancing to that retro. Marcy Beaucoup, I know who you really are, but who really are you? Marcy Beaucoup, I know who you really are, but who really are you? Wanted to retrace Hemingway's steps. I just wanted to eat some crepes. She said, your French is embarrassing me, as she adjusted her frock. I said, I'm just doing for their language what they did to rock. You know I need some action at nature's insistence. I'm trying to break through this funky French resistance. And vibing in the metro, I'm dancing to that retro. Oh baby, I got the cure. Come vibing in the metro. She's been born a Yank. Asked me, could she read some Rambo? I said, not
gotta go. Come from it in the metro.
Came from. This is Helicopter.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just said, you think it's over, and then Joe said, you wish it's over.
Yeah.
That was a Journey to the Center of Guitar Center, which is very funny, and even funnier live. That's how I remembered it.
Yeah, it's I guess that's another self-explanatory true story, Journey to the Center. Actually, the full title is Journey to the Center of Guitar Center, Sherman Oaks.
Oh, is the one in Hollywood, is that a different level of insanity? Because I occasionally go there to get things, but, you know.
They all have their own...
quirks.
Their own way of being insane, yeah. Anyway. But that's a fun song to play live, yeah. People seem to like that. Some people hate it, but they laugh at it. So, yeah, that's okay, too.
Yeah. Well, it's fun to see live, too, because everybody's just doing their thing like the title of the song.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a good one. It's a good one.
Before that was Helicopter. And why is that called Helicopter? No idea.
No idea, yeah. well, that's the thing with the instrumental songs. You can be way more, elaborate or creative or expansive with the titles. Because, it's... sometimes it sounds like something. Like, that definitely sounds like a Journey to the Center of Guitar Center.
Yeah.
But that also could have been a helicopter.
Yeah, it could have, right? Actually.
So you know, there's much more, it's more open. So, I mean, we keep a note running tab of song titles. So we'll be rehearsing and somebody will say something funny.
Yeah.
90% of them are puns, which are not always the funniest thing, but they're funny.
Great for songs.
They're really funny in the room at the moment. They're hilarious. They make it to the notebook. That's another thing. And then if they actually make it to be called a song, it's sort of
baby turtles.
It's like you got 3 stages.
8 million of them. About three of them actually make it to the ocean or make it to adulthood.
Yeah, but we keep a running list of good titles. You know, somebody will say something and we'll just write it down, because anything can work, you know. So we just draw from the pool.
I was going to ask you about something about Panorama City, where the from which we played the track Marcy Buku. Since it was an improvised album, and maybe I'm too hooked into the pop thing, but since an improvised album, how do you handle it when you play them live? You just kind of improvise on...
Well, we've only done it a couple of times because Stu's not around. If Stu was around, we probably would have an opportunity to do more.
Yeah.
We've done it a couple of times with Greg. And, it's kind of like going back and relearning it, really. Like, we try to do the arrangement that these things have ended up being.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because
otherwise...
Well, actually, you know, we have... I think we're going to...
Or is it like jazz, where you have like a motif and then you just mess with that?
Well, we do, except that the problem is we need to... We could be much more open. Like, we could treat the live performance of the song the same way as it was recorded.
Yeah.
And like have a sense of where it might start, but then have it go where it can or wants to.
Yeah.
But we haven't done that. We've been trying to sort of reproduce it.
Sort of be faithful, at least at this point.
A new way, yeah. So then we have to go back and relearn it. And it's mostly relearning the arrangements.
Right.
Because they're not typical song structure.
Yeah.
You know, they're pretty open.
Uh-huh.
They change... If a song has a change, it's usually based around the lyrics as opposed to like 8 bars. You know, it's like not as much musically.
So
based
it's not one of the musicians driving the changes. It was what Stu was doing.
Well, also in the editing, because it's heavily edited too.
Yeah, okay.
You know? I was going to say that
there's a whole nother level than when you're trying to play it live. You got to be faithful to the edit.
That's what we're trying to do. Yeah, but we're going to put out. We're going to make available for downloads like the unedited versions of these and more. There's a lot of stuff.
Ah, marketing.
And so some of them are 20 minutes long, you know, which, so we'd have like a 2-song CD if we put them out like that way.
Yeah.
So we made these into a listenable form. Most of them are not much under One's 3.5, the rest are over 4. Mm-hmm. So they're not, you know, it's not pop song length. But
yeah.
But still, we the full jams are, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes. And they're interesting, you know. I mean, you can... They're for the real dedicated fans. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like...
When you say that, the first thing I'm thinking now is, one, it's probably difficult even for people that are seasoned musicians to stick to this kind of formula that you've been talking about. But it also brings to mind a question that I didn't have on the list here, but I actually thought of.
Yeah.
What's the most difficult thing you've ever done musically?
Oh.
And how do you feel about it now? I mean, are you pissed off about it, or I'm glad that's over, or geez, wish I could do that again? Or
Okay, yeah. Well, something specific does come right to mind, so it must be the most. I did a recording for a good friend. I don't know if you know the band Motor Totemus Guild.
Nope.
But it's a good friend of ours from a long time ago, James Grigsby. He's a composer, and he's had this band for... They used to open shows for the Fibonaccis way back. You know, so they were around in those days. And
I probably saw them once.
You might have, you know, you might have. Did you ever go to the Lhasa Club?
Yes, but I don't think I saw Fibonacci's there.
Okay, because we played there quite a bit.
I went there a few times.
That was a cool place. Yeah,
yeah, I liked that place. Yeah. They had an album, like Lives of Lhasa, and the Fibonacci's were on it.
We have a track.
Disgusting Man was on
it. Yeah, it's the only version of that
that's
officially released.
Yeah.
It's a great song.
It is.
Really funny song. Yeah, it's funny. Do you have that record?
I believe I still have it.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Anyway, what's I talking
he
about?
He taught me how to move and groove.
Yeah. Right.
Difficult to
that's
remember.
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So the Motor Totemus Guild. So James, he's always been this way, like very advanced composer, like a really sort of modern, you know, like modern, almost contemporary, like classical music.
Mm-hmm.
that's the way he writes. And so he asked me to be involved in this project. It was quite a while ago, the mid-90s. So, yeah, that's going way back. he wanted to do a recording of his new pieces, and the plan was to do to culminate in the recording of these pieces. But we did like two or three shows, live shows, as kind of a warm up.
Yeah,
and that's probably the most difficult stuff I've had to play, and it's all written out. Everything is written. I mean, for the drums, there was a little bit of leeway because, you know, I mean, I've seen people that try to write out literally everything for a drummer, and it's crazy because only a certain kind of drummer is going to be able to play it, and generally it's not anything a drummer really would play or want to play.
I don't even know how you would score for a drum.
Well, there's a format.
Like little symbols for everything you've got.
I mean, like, you know, all the
15 floor toms, two writing symbols.
Well, if you get, you know, if the kit gets that ridiculous, then you're going to, you know. But yeah, you basically take a normal staff and the lines instead of, you know, ABC, D, F, G. Yeah, instead of music, it's drums. no, instead of the notes, it becomes a part of the drum kit. So, you know, one line will be for snare drum and then cymbal, and that's how you write it. And then you write the rhythm of it.
So he did that?
He had some things like that. Yeah. I mean, they were rough. They were like suggestions, let's say.
Okay.
But that wasn't the hard part. The hard part was just the rhythms that he wrote. And then it was a big band. It was about a 13-piece band. So there were horns. He'd have some sections where half the band was in one time signature and the other half was in another.
Fun.
And it was really difficult music. And so that
sounds like the Bohunks describing trying to play Raymond Scott.
Yeah.
They said it was the most difficult thing
really?
They'd ever done.
Yeah.
Because of the time changes and everything.
But I think this stuff was harder.
Yeah. You know? It sounds like it.
And I'm not a good enough reader to hang in there. Some of the guys in the band were great. Some of them were worse readers than me, and so, you know, it was tough. I remember the piano player was amazing. She was like this classical pianist, you know, this full-on classical pianist.
Yeah.
So she was nailing it and kind of holding it together. I was hanging in there by a
everybody
thread.
Everybody was kind of like following her as she...
Kind of. You know, I just remember
plunged forward.
How good she was.
Yeah.
But I guess that is some of the most difficult. And also, when you say, would you want to go back? I definitely wish I could go back and redo what I did in the recording.
Yeah.
Because it came out, and it's, you know, it's out there. It's and it's not bad. But personally, I think I could do a lot better. You
know, was the composer happy with it? Must have been.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
Okay.
We did.
Because you're going to hear things that he doesn't.
Yeah, and he's also looking at the bigger picture. I'm just focusing on me.
Right.
You know, of course, and it's like, I wish I hadn't done that, or I wish I did do this. But he's looking at the bigger picture, and he was pretty happy with it. We also did some pieces that were improvised, that he had these graphic scores.
Uh-huh.
Which are more fun. I mean, you kind of, you can't go wrong, you know. And it was such a relief to try to play this really hard, like really full-on composed music that's really difficult. And then all of a sudden get to just follow a graph.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, this is great. This is like playtime. And you need that.
Yeah.
He was smart in that way.
Yeah.
You know, you need that balance.
Did he do it just for the musicians, or because it was part of?
No, he did it. We recorded it, and it actually sounds as equally as interesting to me as the. And I think I was a little more satisfied with that. But it was cool.
What is it? What is the title?
I don't remember. City, something about city of something. We can look it up.
Okay.
It's. It came out on CD.
Uh-huh.
You know, at the time.
Well, I'd like to hear it now.
Yeah, yeah, well, we've got to hear it now. I'm sure it's on something, digital format.
Somewhere.
Yeah.
And what was the composer's name again?
James Griggs. Well, the band was called Motor Totemus Guild.
Oh, okay.
Motor Totemus Guild, yeah. Yeah, I should look that up and see what's available. It's called, I want to say City of Lights, but that's too...
Yeah, that's
it. It could be that, but that's too obvious. Yeah. Or City of Dreams is equally obvious.
Yeah. But. City, Boulevard of Broken Cities.
Yeah. Anyway, that's an interesting question. I'm pretty solidly that's the answer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'm not going to bug you too much more. I had one other weird question.
Sure.
What's the last concert you attended? Like a big concert.
Yeah, I'm trying to think.
And then conversely, what's the last little gig you went to go to the gig?
Right.
Like, I want to go see these people.
Yeah, I can answer that easily because it was recent. The last thing I was at Cafe Nela, and it was a good band. It was with, do you remember that girl, Jatan, who was sang in Christian Death?
Yes. But, yes.
Yeah, yeah. She had a band way back, again, the early Fibonacci days that we used to play on bills together, a band called Pompeii 99. And
that's for some reason that makes.
They were around. You know, we used to play at Al's Bar quite a bit. And the funny thing about that now is the main funny thing is that Mark Doten was about 19 years old.
Yeah, bassist
played
for
bass. Yeah, he's the bassist in Double Knot Spy Car. Played bass in Pompeii 99, and so I would have met him back then.
Yeah,
With that band, I don't remember him at all because we weren't like friends. I was friends with the two main people, but I didn't really know the rest of the band. And so it's just funny to think about that. You know, I had actually met Mark. Kind of, it feels like in another life. You know.
Yeah.
Because he was like, I guess a little. He wasn't a full-on goth kid, but I think he was playing that role.
Well, goth then.
No, I mean, these guys actually were... Christian
they
Death
were,
was,
but they wasn't
one,
called
no,
that.
But Christian Death was one, I was going to say, was one of the really originators from the West Coast goth scene, which is actually pretty big.
Yeah.
You know, I think there was stuff going on in England, but as far as West Coast, they were one of the first, you know.
Yeah.
If not the
somebody in Albuquerque used to live here turned me on to a band called Castration Squad.
Mm-hmm.
It was a bunch of girls. It was like a girl punk goth band.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and there's one recording of them live.
Right, I definitely remember that name. That's a pretty memorable name.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's you won't forget that name. But anyway, I went to see Jatan has a new band with her and Rick Agnew, who's an L.A.
legend. R.I.K.K. Agnew.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I remember
he's from,
him.
Is it Agent Orange? I don't remember which.
I think
one
so,
of the,
yeah. He was an OC punk
OC
guy.
Punk bands.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And Paul Rossler.
A friend of mine knew him pretty well.
Paul Rossler plays keyboards in that
Okay.
band. So I went to see them, and it was great. I loved it. Yeah, they were really cool. They, yeah. And actually, they asked me if I would do some gigs playing drums, because they don't have a drummer. They use a kind of like sequence bass lines. There's not really like a drum machine, but there's this sort of pounding sound that they have. And they want, I don't know why they want a drummer, but they do. So,
you know what? They wanted me to change sort of, their sound.
Well, I don't want to do that. You know, that, I just want to pretend like I'm Tony Williams in a goth band. I don't know. But anyway, I'll probably
just put on,
give
you know,
a try with that.
Put on silver makeup and dress in black.
Yeah,
something.
Well, that's half the battle. Yeah. But that was the last club gig that I went to, and it was memorable. It was particularly good. You know?
Yeah.
So big concert. It's been a long time.
Of any kind of music.
I mean,
it doesn't matter, but
what
was the last one?
I'm really drawing a blank. Because I want to say something that was probably 3 or 4 years ago, and that seems like way too long.
No, if it was the last one.
No. I got to think about that. Because I really don't, I just don't go to very many of those things.
I kind of think, when I think about it, I wouldn't think you'd be interested.
It's not, well.
Or you're so into your thing, it's kind of like.
No, I'm interested. It's just, it would take.
Okay, what would you go
see?
Who would you go see if there was a concert?
Well, okay.
Even if they're not together anymore.
I saw that television just played in town. Remember
oh, really?
Yeah. They played.
I'm so uncool. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, well.
Maybe I did hear about that.
I heard that they were playing. Didn't go. So.
Yeah.
Oh, I know the concert. Okay, I know the concert. I know it would take me a minute. Anyway, so I would go to see television. I didn't go to see television.
Yeah.
King Crimson was in town 6 months ago.
Right, yeah. My friend Griff told me about that. I think he went.
Yeah. So I'm a big King Crimson fan. From a long time. I've seen him a bunch of times from way back. So,
yeah.
So I'm a fan, you know. I love him. And I was interested. I mean, I'm not that interested in seeing a lot of old bands. It kind of contradicts what I just said. Like, I'd like to go see television. But
it depends.
But there's certain bands that I would want to see, and television wouldn't be one, and King Crimson would be another. So it's like, I really want to go to that, and it's like, yeah, it's kind of pricey. I'm kind of like not so flush right now. So I don't know if I'm going to go. Maybe I'll go, maybe not. And Kira had gone. They went the night before. Like, they were in town for 2 nights. They went and said, oh, it was great. It was just amazing. And maybe you should think about getting a ticket for the next night. It was so good.
Yeah.
And and I was like, yeah, I should. But I didn't. So about 5 o'clock, I get a text from a friend that says, this other guy, Mark, our mutual friend, Mark says, you probably would be into this. I have I bought a ticket to see King Crimson, and I got a gig on the road. So I'm sitting in a van in New York, and I have a ticket to King Crimson that I can email you if you want to go.
Yeah.
So I was just destined to go. So I said, yeah, hell's yes, I'm going to go.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was free. I could get in, and all worked. The ticket worked.
All the stars aligned.
I printed it out, and I went, and it was down at the Orpheum Theater downtown. It's a beautiful new remodeled.
They fixed it up. Okay.
Yeah, they're doing that a lot to those really cool old.
Is that on Broadway with all the others?
I think it is on Broadway.
Down the lower part of Broadway.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay. And they did. It's beautiful. You know, it's a really nice theater. I can't say the sound is amazing because it's just not amazing, but it was good enough. And,
yeah.
But anyway, that's the last concert I went to, and that would have been 6 to 9 months ago, I would say. Yeah. It was great, I have to say. The thing, I mean, for me as a drummer, I was skeptical because the tour was going to be a new lineup with three drummers. So talk about overkill. I was like, how is this going to work?
By one more.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I was curious, skeptical, and they actually did it great. They sort of made it work. So I was really happy. Yeah, and the drummers are all great, of course, and Yeah, so that was... How could I forget that? It just took me a minute. Yeah, that was my last last thing. You know, I don't like the crowd scene.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't either.
All that kind of stuff. So
I'll put up with it sometimes if I really want to see something. Yeah. But yeah, I kind of don't anymore.
It was funny this to go to this show and I went by myself because I just had the one ticket. So yeah. I'm just there by myself, and. It was probably sold out or nearly crowded.
Yeah, I guess it would be.
You know, it was crowded. Yeah, they don't come around much. And it's not that big a place. So right next to me was this young guy. And I don't know where he was from. I think he was South American or something. But he was probably early 20s. So, you know, and it was... Anyway, I found out later. It was the first time he had seen King Crimson. He was a huge fan. But he was so enthusiastic. Like, at first it was annoying because he was really, like, hooting and hollering.
Yeah.
And about halfway through, I kind of grew to like the fact of his enthusiasm. And then after the show, we kind of became buds for a minute. We were just chatting, you know.
Yeah.
He was asking me about, you know, like, had I seen them before? And so we were sort of, like, had this... conversation, and he was just this cool kid, and he was so excited to be there that it was kind of contagious. Like I said, at first it was annoying, and then it was like, oh, this is cool.
But the
it
thing
makes
is,
for an experience of,
that young would be into that music is kind of like,
yeah, exactly. So that was fun, you know. So the idea of a crowd and all was like, yeah, okay, well, you know, some people are okay, but yeah,
so. It depends on a lot of things. I think I'm going to let you go, but what are you working on now, and what can people expect besides going and seeing you next week
next
on Saturday at
Saturday,
7?
July 18th, 7 o'clock at the Folly Bowl in Altadena.
Yes.
Yeah. Besides that, we have some Spycar gigs coming up. We're always playing around, and if anybody's interested in that, it's... also, we have a website, you know, doublenotspycar.com, and also a Facebook page that we update the Facebook page.
Okay.
Much more because it's just easier. So you can find out about gigs. And, you know, just other than those main projects, you know, just I do a lot of one-off things. And, yeah.
We'll going to keep going too, right?
Yeah. And we've been working on a collection of covers. we can actually go out on one if you want. I'll play one for you. We've been working on a collection of covers of just really varied, just stuff that we like. There's not some method to former hits or something. It's just stuff we really like. So, it's slow coming. It's taken us a long time, but, that's how we work. So, that'll be right here. And just around. Just around. But we'll do the second shift of this. Anyway, this is a cover of a David Bowie tune from Low, probably my favorite Bowie.
Track number is what?
It's track one.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And it's also predominantly an instrumental, so Kiro did all the vocals, did the melody lines vocally.
Oh wow!
Without words, and it's a Brian Eno song, but it's on Bowie Low, and it's called Warsawa. So check it out.
Oh yeah, that one. Do you want to say thank you after that, or I just thank you now?
Oh well, yeah, I'll thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's been great. Really fun.
It's been a long time coming too. We've been talking about this for years, and it's just kind of like finally we connected. And,
well, you know, now you can't get rid of me. So yeah,
good.
No, it was really fun. I do appreciate it. And if anybody was listening, thanks for hanging in there.
All right, and also I'm going to figure some way to cajole, bribe, or somehow get Ron to. Agree to at least do a one-off somewhere.
If you can do that, you are, we'll be forever in your debt. That's for sure.
And I do. Likewise. The last time I saw you was the Fibonacci's, that band, was at the Music Machine in West L.A.
Oh, man.
I remember John kicked his keyboard over.
Really?
You played, I think it was Purple Haze, and he kicked the keyboard over.
Oh yeah, okay, for effect, yeah. That's great. Yeah, we couldn't smash it. We just had to knock it over.
He just kind of gently knocked it over. It was still kind of like he's knocking his keyboard over.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Joe. And
all right, thanks.
Check out all the stuff that we've been talking about, and I think we'll probably make it less time between talking about it and doing a coming on again and talking about whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, cool.
Waiting for the message to come, the handshake from deepest